Three messages before we get started. If you're a tech entrepreneur, don't you have unique legal needs that the average lawyer can't help you with? That's why you need Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you read his articles on VentureBeat, you know that he can help you with issues like raising money or issuing stock options or even deciding whether to form a corporation. Scott Edward Walker is the entrepreneur's lawyer. See him at walkercorporatelaw.com. And do you remember when I interviewed Sarah Sutton Fell about how thousands of people pay for her job site? Look at the biggest point that she made. She said that she has a phone number on every page of her site because, and here's a stat, 95% of the people who call end up buying. Most people, though, don't call her, but seeing a real number increases their confidence in her and they buy. So try this. Go to grasshopper.com and get a phone number that will make your company sound professional. Add it to your site and see what happens. Grasshopper.com. And remember Patrick Buckley, who I interviewed? He came up with an idea for an iPad case. He built a store to sell it, and in a few months, he generated about $1 million in sales. Well, the platform he used is Shopify. If you have an idea to sell anything, set up your store on Shopify.com because Shopify stores are designed to increase sales. Plus, Shopify makes it easy to set up a beautiful store and manage it. Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And yet again, I've got an interview for you with an entrepreneur who used to listen to Mixergy interviews, just like you're listening to them right now. And in this interview, I want to find out how a novelist like today's interviewee who couldn't support his family by writing a book. Whoa, what is this? The way I'm reading this is awful. Let me read it from scratch. How does a novelist who couldn't support his family with his writing build a $150,000 a month business? If you've heard me say in the past that entrepreneurs should find their customer's pain, wait till you see the first thing today's customer did. Boy, I got to tell you, Michael, I'm screwing this whole in, and I'm not even editing it out. I'm keeping the whole thing in. I'm just going to, instead of continuing with this blundered intro, I'm just going to say today's guest is Michael Fitzgerald. He's the co-founder of Submittable, which makes it easy for people to accept and review digital content. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew.
The $150,000 in business, it's not revenue. Before we started this interview, you were explaining to me what it was, and I said, let's just have you explain it. Especially since I'm fumbling my own intro, I might as well have you explain what the numbers mean.
Sure. So people use us for accepting application fees, contest entries, reading fees, and we create revenue from that. We get a per transaction. Many of our customers use us for free, and we only make money when they do that. And so we do about $150,000 in transactions per month, and then we have about a third of that in revenue.
Okay. And the first thing that you did to come up with this idea was make a list. What was that list?
Yeah. So how the company started was in 2008. My partner, Bruce Tribbenzy, and I were at lunch, and we were both developers. Bruce is a filmmaker. I was a novelist, or I'm a novelist. But we had always paid our bills by writing software. Bruce has worked at Borland, Oracle. I've done work for Microsoft, a company that I worked for before Proclarity was bought by Microsoft. And but we live in a rural part of the world. We live in Missoula, Montana. And we were both doing consulting work, and we had gone out to lunch, and we said we should start a company. And mostly because we enjoyed each other, and we were getting to the age where we, I guess, didn't want to work for somebody. And so we were at lunch, and I just said, we should make a list of things we don't like or things that we think could be better. And in 2 or 3 seconds, as a writer, I send out manuscripts routinely. And I had noticed over the course of over the last 10 years, everybody was using a different system, or they were using email, or they were using post. And there was all these sort of convoluted ways of getting your work in front of publishers or agents. And it seemed technically a really simple problem to solve. So it must have been like a Monday or Tuesday that we were having lunch. And that Sunday, what you usually do as a writer is you send out most of your work on a Sunday or a Monday. You finish something, you work all weekend on something, and you finish it on Sunday night, and you put in envelopes or you email it to wherever. So I had just said the process of submitting work was a nightmare. And I described how many different publishers had different systems, and some used email, and you never knew where it went. And the post office, you had to print something out, bring it down. And so, and Bruce said it's a Submish Mash, which was what our first name was, which was Submish Mash. So Submish we didn't mash. Know what the solution was. We just Submish Mash.
You know, let me pause right there before we continue with the rest of the story. I'm wondering why the first step to starting your company was to write out a list of your own problems. Why wouldn't it be to say, what's a good idea? Or what can we do better than the competition? Why'd you specifically take this approach of saying, what are my problems? Why go inward like that?
Well, I don't think we had, maybe I'd read that somewhere. I don't think that, you know, we knew that we were sort of in the middle of nowhere and we weren't going to launch the next Facebook or something. So we knew we had to really, truly solve a problem instead of creating an industry. It just seemed obvious that there's a lot of problems in the world. I don't know if they're mutually exclusive, like solving a problem or coming up with a great idea. But I don't know why we thought that. But we did make a list, and this was, and literally within, you know, we probably said two or three things, but this was obvious to us. It was obvious that we knew the industry, and Bruce as a filmmaker had the exact same problem. And we later brought on a third partner, John Brownell, and he is a musician, and he had a very similar problem, which is sort of, it's both getting your work, it's mostly about getting your work out there. And so what we fixed was a little piece in that process of getting your work out there. So we went home, the domain name was available, and we just started writing code. And the original thing we thought we would solve is, wasn't at all what we have. We built this social network around sort of the curation process. It was essentially a marketplace, similar to like AngelList or something, where you had quote unquote gatekeepers or publishers or producers. And you had creators, people making stuff, and needed to get it in front of those people. So we built this social network, and publishers could create an account and accept work and review it. And then we put metadata around it, you know, the ability for certain genres to find the right people. And the problem with the marketplace is the chicken and the egg. And we built that for 8 months, 9 months. And it was pretty obvious as soon as we launched. The hurdles that we were gonna face. So then we ripped out 90% of the functionality.
What were the hurdles?
The hurdles, the chicken and the egg problem is who comes first, right? Do you get the producers and the publishers, or do you get the writers and the artists? It would be pretty obvious that you get, you know, the numbers are with the creators, like the number of, but you know, I called publishers directly. And they straight up said, I don't have a problem of needing more content, and I don't trust you three guys in Montana to take care of it. So
at what point did you call up those publishers?
We were going to release on December 9th in 2009. I think it was a Monday. And I had slowly been talking to some of them over the course of 3 months while we were, I would get people to look at what we'd built. I was showing it to anybody who would look at it. And as a published author, I sort of have a pretty direct connection to a lot of publishers. So I would just email them, ask them if they'd look at it. You know, they were all interested. It looked like real software, but without content or without thousands of people in it, it's hard to really envision what a marketplace is like. But the one thing they all said was this curation bit is really cool. The ability for us to read and vote and comment and sort of easily curate any object that comes into their sort of drop-off.
By us, you mean the publishers internally wanted to vote. They didn't want the community. They didn't want other publishers to help them. They just internally wanted to vote up the content that they were getting.
That's exactly right. They had a process. It's very hard to change people like dramatically. And they had a system that they went through, quote unquote, the slush pile. And so what we really just did was digitalize something that they were already doing at a very low cost. And it makes them look professional. So we took something that was an outward-facing marketplace and made it a software as a service.
You told April, who pre-interviewed you for us here at Mixergy, that you realized that your problem as a writer was caused by the problems that the customers were having.
Yeah.
That it was their problem that you needed to solve first, not your problem. Their problem led to your problem, and you needed to address their problem first, right?
That's correct.
So yeah. Talk to me about the process that you took was a good one of saying, where are my issues? If I were going to do the same thing but avoid the mistake that you made, how would I adjust that process? If I were to start with what my problems are, how do I avoid going down the wrong path of solving my own problem and realizing that's not where the money is, that's not where the action is, that's not what drives the relationship, and then find the person who does?
Well, so if I was going to do this over, the thing I learned very quickly was, one, the market. I didn't understand the dynamics of starting a marketplace, you know, and I think that's something that a lot of people have run into in the last 5 or 6 years, people who have tried to create Etsy-type situations. So you need to, you know, it's a really nuanced thing. You really need to figure out who's the very first customer, and not overshoot or not, you know, shoot too broadly. And then... So I think if I was to do it again, I would just understand, I mean, straight up, a marketplace is very hard to do without a boatload of capital. and two, what problem are you truly, truly solving? So my problem was that I couldn't target people. I thought it was that I couldn't target publishers well enough, and I couldn't get them to like read things. And the reason I couldn't get them to do it is because they had no easy way of doing it. They had no easy way of engaging, no matter how great the book is. Like, you know, my sense is the best novels in the world never get published, because it's just a very different muscle to write a book or to create a film than it is to distribute it, sell it, and all that stuff. I mean, I think I you know, your bio, I think did you and your brother start your first company?
Yeah.
And you had an engineer and you had someone who could sincerely sell the product. Yeah. And I think writers don't always get that. It's very hard to understand how valuable sales is and marketing and stuff until you have to.
You spent months where you didn't talk to publishers, even though you wanted them in your network, not formally. It took you a while to understand, the way that they do things is they internally start to look at the same document. They vote on it. They have problems making sure that they're looking at the same document, in that they have trouble making sure that they're voting. What was the hesitation there?
There wasn't a hesitation. There was a hesitation on the first one is, as developers, you know, you most engineers hold themselves to a standard, and you know that's sort of an ongoing. You can never like you're always terrified of getting in front of real people. Like, there's always something you can add to it. And I think as inexperienced entrepreneurs, we held on to it for too long. Two, I had a real job, like, you know, we were piecemealing our lives together. We had no idea about how long it would take. We were pretty much wrong about everything. We were wrong about the original customer. We were wrong about how, you know, we thought we would release it on a Monday, and by Friday we'd be, you know, our biggest problem would be how to count the money. And then we were wrong about the problem we were solving. So I think I'm not going to, you know, I don't know if I can say anything new about this, but like, get it in front of people as soon as humanly possible.
But here's the thing. You eventually did talk to publishers, which many people wouldn't do. We don't hear the stories of the people who know that they need to talk to publishers and don't end up doing it, or know that they need to talk to their eventual users.
Yeah.
I want to understand what you did to get over that obstacle, get over that reluctance.
It was just pure fear. I mean, I had to make this work. I mean, we had worked very hard. And
why did you have to make it work? You're a developer, you could have gotten another job. You're a writer, you could have said, what am I doing with this craziness of going and starting yet another business in this world? I should just focus more on my writing. There are tons of excuses that you could have given yourself, but What was it that overcame all those excuses?
Well, writing a novel was a very good lesson because, similar to starting a company, no one asks you to do it. No one cares if you finish. Like, you start a book, and then, you know, the first year you're telling people at cocktail parties I'm writing a book. By the second year, they're kind of embarrassed for you. By the third year, you just, like, they don't go to those cocktail parties anymore. Starting a company is a very similar thing, right? Everyone's like, great, you know, you're gonna be the next Facebook or whatever. And then very quickly there, you know, it just gets ugly very fast, right? And people are starting to avoid you. And so I knew from writing a book that it was an ugly, bumpy grind. You know, like, you would have to. And so I wasn't, at some point I was like, okay, well, this isn't working. We don't have customers yet. So how do we get customers? So I knew, I'd done something that had taken 5 years to do. So I knew I had that lesson in my back pocket. Well, okay, well, if it's not working, we just change something.
But still, the overcoming, I'll tell you, it's tough even for me. I have conversations with strangers all the time, with people who I admire and I'm intimidated by all the time. And still, picking up the phone sometimes and talking to someone who could eventually reject my idea or say, hey, you thought you were so smart. This is absolute crap. It's tough. It's a big obstacle. How did you overcome it? Did it happen a little at a time? Did it happen because you were forced?
Well, we were forced to.
By who?
But I also... That's it.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
We were forced to because we had to eventually get customers, and it was on me. I talked these two, you know, people who I really admire into spending time. Like, I felt their pressure. I'd taken away time from my kids and my family. So, you know, you sort of owe it to them. I mean, I think Brad Feld has a thing about how your wife is your biggest investor. You know, they had all paid for this too. So at some point your back's against the wall and you have to call people. And I also was very familiar with rejection. You know, writing, you know, your first year of writing, you get 100 rejections. So I kind of was totally comfortable with people telling me that was idiotic. And I don't know if that's a good thing. It probably lets me screw up for a lot longer time than most people. But I look at rejection as sort of the brand of life. You know, it's just good for you.
You know, I want to come back to what writing taught you, because the habits that you developed there helped you become a better entrepreneur. But let's stick with this for a bit longer, this need to succeed. You're at a stage where many entrepreneurs in my audience will say it's tough for them to start a business, maybe even impossible because they have a family, because they have a mortgage. You had that. And instead of saying, hey, it's tough for me to have done this, you say it was tough for me to quit because I had that. Why is it different?
I definitely didn't have any choice. Like, we were absolutely going to succeed. We've been broke. Like, you know, we've had down months, and especially in the beginning, but it never was like, oh, we should give up. It was how do we fix this? And I don't know. Failing is never. I just knew it was going to take a lot longer than everybody thought, and I knew that. That lesson was already there. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, let's talk about that lesson then. You told April that you used to get up at 5 a.m. to write.
Oh yeah, sure.
How did you get that discipline? How long would you write?
Again, it was just desperation, you know, like, I had a family, I had a job, I had a 9-to-5 job. And so it had to get done at some point. So I knew, and I had some success, right? Like, so if you do this crazy thing, you wake up every morning from 5 to 8 and you just put out 2 or 3 pages, and it eventually works, then you feel like you've learned that secret, right? Okay, well, you just work harder, or you just don't give up. And then you don't. That's the secret of not failing, is just not allowing yourself to fail ever.
But you've also said that the pride of having accomplished it a few times fueled you to continue a few more times and a few more times until you got into the habit. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, like, so you get little pats on the back along the way, right? Like, eventually, in the beginning, you just never think, oh, well, I'm no good, right? But like everything, you just get better and better. And I think, you know, people think I think a lot of people outside of the entrepreneur community think that it's a good idea. Like the company's all about some idea you had, like inspiration. And that's a very similar conversation in the writing and in the art world. Like, oh, I've got a great idea for a novel. Like the number of people who tell you that. Yeah. I think anybody who's ever done it knows that it's really just about doing it and not about the idea. And I've found that entrepreneurship is the exact same thing. It's just about showing up every day when you absolutely don't want to, when you've just had a week of rejections, like when things have fallen through and the sun turns. And if you're just there the next day, you just keep your butt in the chair longer than your competition and you win, right? Like
But how do you do that? You told TechNet back in October of 2012, I'm presently in a bad relationship with our own product. Wild swings from loving it blindly to hating every screen. We break up every Friday night, and then I propose again on Monday morning. Tell me about one thing that you hate about your product and makes you want to just stay away from the whole business out of almost embarrassment.
Yeah. Well, right now it's actually looking good. We're having a
How
good
about
month.
back then in October?
Yeah.
I want something concrete so that we can follow along the feeling that you had with you.
Yeah. So Bruce, John, and I, the three people who the three founders are, we have a similar development skill set that we're pretty traditional back-end developers. And if we have a weakness, it's UI and design. Right, so we'll spend like 3 months on a feature that was pretty heavy duty engineering, and we release it and we know what it can do and we know how powerful it is. Say something simple like custom forms, like the ability to drag and drop and build totally custom forms for an organization. We empower anybody to do that, and but the first version, it works, it absolutely works. It's just not beautiful, right? And there's just this stabbing feeling that you've worked for 3 months on something, but just purely like I can't draw, like I'm not like an artist, I can't, and that pains you, and like you stay up at night thinking like, well, maybe I should go to art school for 6 months, or like how do you get that skill set? I mean, I think most entrepreneurs are used to just figuring something out. Like I'm not a natural salesperson, but I've learned to sell enough that. That we're not out of business yet, but design, like that's a slight, like they're like the best designers do have some talent. And is that something you can learn? It drives you nuts, right? Like
And then in comparison to what you know the finished product should look like, yours just looks like crap.
that's right. We get 90% of the way there. I mean, that's really the biggest problem. Like you've worked so hard, you've got something that's totally valuable. It's 90% of the way there. And I don't have the innate talent to like put it to 100%. So, you go out. I mean, obviously there's ways of fixing that problem. I think we did fix that specific problem, but it drives you nuts.
Wonder how you get over it. Like, for me, I'll sometimes have a bad interview. Even in this interview, I'm worried, well, I didn't really go through a proper narrative here. We didn't start with the takeoff point and go through the ups and downs along the way properly. There's no arc and so on. And I would almost just say, I'm a crappy interviewer, I'm never doing this again. Or if not explicitly like that, I might procrastinate because there's a hidden feeling that I'm not even in touch with that says, you're a crappy interviewer, just don't do it again. The only thing that keeps me going again is in about an hour, I have another interview scheduled and I have to do it again. And then maybe that one will be good and then I'll want to do the next one. So it's that schedule that keeps me going even when I'm full of self-doubt or when I want to procrastinate. What is it for you? What's that outside element that helps you?
I mean, the outside element is definitely I've got two kids to feed. That doesn't sound very inspiring, I mean, there's the feeding them, and then there's the mortgage. But you also do you have children? Do you have
No,
kids?
not yet.
They're just these little people looking at you all day, and you want to give them both skills that they can go have productive, engaging, hopefully fun lives. They listen to everything. You talk like they're just like little tape recorders, and they say everything you say, and they watch you sitting there stressing out. So I think, but being inspiring to them, or not inspiring, but being, I mean, that sounds really sort of base, but just being a good example is, I don't want them to ever give up, or, you know, I don't, I see, you know, that kind of thing. But the 10% of making something perfect is, I mean, to be, well, with writing, I knew it was similar, that I knew that things didn't pop. Like Pat Benatar, I think, it's Blondie, has a quote, you learn to play guitar and then you get sexy. And I think that that's really too, like, you've got to be a journeyman. You've got to, like, just show up every day and do the thing. But eventually it sort of, like, moves into being an artist, right? But you just have to have all the skills at your fingertips before it starts to turn into an art. But you want it to be, you want everything, it's just got to go a little past just being functional. It's got to be sort of different or interesting and beautiful, ideally, you know?
It's interesting that you would say first you have to do the work, then you get to be an artist. That I almost feel like they must be two separate things. At first you just be an artist and then never do the work.
No. I mean, there's a huge misconception that artists, I think there's this idea of artist as sort of a dilettante. Actually, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what my dad thinks artists are. But I think anybody who's really gotten anywhere with it knows that it's, you know, it's like 100% effort and then a bunch of luck. And I think, yeah, you know.
Waking up at 5 a.m. and putting in 3 hours of writing, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, but it eventually turns into fun, right? Like, I loved doing it after a while. In the beginning, like the first year that I did, I was like, oh, you know, there was something sort of cheesy and macho about it. But eventually, like, that's actually one of the biggest things I miss right now about, like, this is really engaging and fun, like starting a company and hundreds of thousands of customers, and that's totally... that's wild, right? But I, like, the 3 hours where I used to just sit in our garage and put like two or three pages down, and sort of you take your life and put it into some sort of narrative, that felt it felt like something that separates you from sort of your dog, or
separates you from your job, you said.
Like, it's what humans are. We're built. No, your dog, D-O-G. Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry, that it separates you from your dog?
Yeah, like, you know, as a species, like a human. You know.
Oh, I see. That this thought that I put into my life is what separates me from my dog and other animals.
I reflect on my life.
I see.
And I make something out of that reflection. Like, you know, that's what I felt you were doing when you're taking art, you're sort of reflecting on all this, like, what we experience during the day.
You know, the reason that I screwed up the intro was, here's what that first sentence that I wrote was. How does a novelist who, let me wait for the video to catch up. Can you hear me in real time now, or is it still a little bit slow?
I can hear you in real time.
Okay, good. So the video is slow, but the audio is caught up. Here's what it said. It said, how does a novelist who couldn't support his family with his writing build a $150,000 a month business? And it's that first part that I was too embarrassed to say, which is why I tripped up. Like, who am I to say that he couldn't support his family? Or just even talking about that, not being able to support your family is enough. It just felt too awkward to say about another human being.
Yeah.
You lived it. And I feel that it was okay for me to have written it there because you told April that that was a challenge. If it was hard for me to say it, is what I'm trying to get at. What was it like to live it? To live the inability to support your family doing what you love?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, that's a pretty universal, I mean, every artist has that problem. I mean, there's, you know, Stephen King, and then there's the other million people who write. But it was, you know, it's not something you learn all at once. It was, while you can put it off for a long time, it's similar to not talking to customers, because you can write a book for 5 years and assume at the end there's going to be a payday, right? So you don't really have to tackle that question. And then you actually get a book, and then you're like, okay, well, can I sell it? And I, you know, we got it reviewed. It was in the New York Times, you know, it was in bookstores and everything. So there are all these little things like, well, if it just does this, then I'll be able to make enough money. If the book just says this, and you just you learn all those things one piece at a time, right? So it wasn't like this ongoing struggle. It's just like I mean, I would have a problem with that sentence too, because that really isn't why, oh, I can't make it as a writer, I should start a software company. It was more like, I want autonomy and this is how I work and I can't imagine working for somebody else. I mean, you write books for a lot of reasons, or you do art for a lot of reasons. You definitely don't do it to be rich, but you do it, you know, there's some great things. There's autonomy, you know, you don't work for anybody. It's a very engaging and enriching process. That's very similar to starting a company.
But the acceptance of it seems tough. Like, is it that what it is? Is it acceptance that, hey, you know what? I thought I was special as a writer. I thought I was smarter than all those other people because I'm a developer. I think logically. I should have made it. And then is it just acceptance of, hey, you know what? This just isn't going to work. And then you have to battle with yourself.
I guess I don't disagree because I haven't given up writing. I'm writing a book called Start Down, which is, you know, I didn't start this company because I couldn't make it as a novel. I just wanted something that was both. I mean, this in many ways both satisfies the urge to create and the desire for autonomy, but it also it makes money. It makes a lot more money.
And it does because you changed it. That early on, it was going to be a submit mash. It was going to be kind of a social network. It was going to be a marketplace. And then you talk to the people who are really making the decisions and driving this industry, and you realize, wait, they're not going to participate in this. They want something different. How do you change once you discover that? What do you do to change to get to a place where you are today with Submittable, a company that's growing and doing well?
Well, you just talk, I mean, you talk to your customers and it, I mean, like there's no, like right now it's much harder to make decisions. Like if I make a decision right now, I'm changing 100,000 people's, you know, we make a UI change, 100,000 people see that. It, back then, that original decision, you know, I called Bruce and John and just said, you know, this is what we're doing. And I mean, I'd have to ask them, but I think they might have thought, oh, Michael's losing it a little bit, but let's just let him go. And as soon as we got one or two customers, it was obvious. Like as soon as people started using it, it was absolutely greatest decision.
I'm sorry, the connection again. I've had past interviewees get on the phone with me privately and say, Andrew, here's what you need to do to really fix Mixergy. And then they start giving me all these different ideas that will send the business in a whole other direction. And I feel like, yes, that makes a lot of sense, but that is so overwhelming. I don't even know where to start. And here, not only did you start, but you fully adjusted your business. You called it a pivot, I think, in your conversation with April, but it's more than a pivot. It's like a whole new business that found light where the other one didn't. So where do you start? How do you keep from feeling overwhelmed? What's the first thing you do? I just threw three questions at you.
Yeah. Walk me through the first thing, I think it's always important to just do something every day to like, I think, it's just, you know, like, am I going to start a company? Like looking back, oh, am I going to start a company? Starting a company now seems incredibly overwhelming because I didn't know how hard it was when you started. Right. But I make a point to do something no matter what every day. Like, you know, there's always low hanging fruit, even if it's just like, put a page on the website or, call this person. My most productive hour now is always it's the last hour before I go home because I just have this list of things that I haven't done yet. Right. Like you can kind of screw around or like get on the phone or like do work on the big things that are going to take months. But the last hour, just get like four or five things off your plate. And I think, it's obviously very incredibly valuable to just do something every day.
So what was the low hanging fruit when it was time to adjust from Submit Mash to what became Submittable?
The low hanging fruit was we were cutting out code. So we cut out 90% of the code base, which as you know, all three of us as developers felt, didn't feel great. but I hate, I've said this like 5 times, but similar to writing, one of the first lessons you learn is being able to throw away is just as important.
So what did you
And
throw away and what did you keep?
we threw away the entire social network. We threw away the entire outward-facing centralized system. We kept the authentication, so it's centralized authentication, but then we made it business focused. You know, it's an app that you plug into your business's website. So we just and we threw out the users. You know, I we had sort of these fake users, and okay, they're not users anymore. And just who is this editor? And the very first version was just built specifically for an editor with no money and wanting to create, wanting to find awesome voices, and how do they engage in that? And the market, and then the next thing you do is listen to the market. The market tells you, you know, you might be building software that works for one individual, but there's the obvious hurdles of getting them to sign up, getting them comfortable with it, getting, you know, just getting them to plug it into their
So it was
website.
just for the editor, a way for him or her to get submissions. That
Yeah.
was what, after 90% was scrapped, that's essentially what the product was.
How do I accept digital content?
Gotcha. Okay, so you coded up a way to accept digital content. Did you start taking that then to editors and saying, what do you think?
Yep. And we immediately got a bunch of, you know, we got some beta testers, and we also got very lucky to talk to some really super smart, super Adam Robinson, who has a publishing company in Baltimore called Publishing Genius. I mean, he's a gifted writer on his own, but he's also a bit of a quote unquote tastemaker. You know, like he tiptoed into it. He just happened to be one of the first people we talked to, and he not just like what his feedback was on the product, but his feedback. I was like, he is an awesome customer. He's like smart. He uses it to make books that I really engage in and that I think are incredibly valuable. So like, how do I get this person to be our customer? You know, luckily he was there and I could just ask him. So he could kind of what's a palatable price. And so once we made it for him, you know, the VC probably don't want to hear that I'm making software for a poet in Baltimore, but if you can solve that person's problem, you know, somebody, a total stranger to you, then you know, you're on your way.
That makes sense. All right. And then, actually, before I continue, did you say fake users?
Yeah, sure.
You did what Reddit did. You created a bunch of users.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, we had, you know, so personas. So fake, you know, fake people who are going to use your software. So
Oh,
a persona.
interesting. What, how would you put those together?
Mostly I would just make them up, and I would talk to, you know, I would just name somebody Mark, and Mark would have, I actually had I'd ghost written a book for Microsoft executive about usability. So I sort of knew what personas were, and I knew about trends in usability. And this was like in 2006. And so a persona is just a collection. I mean, ideally you go and do market research, but you know, you can also, you know, we did market research, but not how an MBA would do it. We
Mostly it
would.
was you sitting down saying, Will is a writer who wants his stuff to actually be looked at. Will is this kind of a person. He's experienced these kinds of programs, Facebook, Google, etc., but he hasn't dug deep in and so on, and
That's
doesn't
right.
do GitHub. And then you have someone else. Mark is, that's the way you did it. And it's essentially you envisioning who you want your users to be, not based on tons of market research.
That's right. I would say 25% market research and 75% you know, we're not idiots. We can just sort of myself, I was the end user.
Yeah, you're living in the space. I could never have even thought of this product, let alone started to build it. Even if I knew that I was wrong with the first version, started having conversations with editors, I don't believe that I would have gotten as much out of them as you did. And of course, then I wouldn't have been able to create Submittable. What is it as a person who's lived in this space that you were able to pick up on that someone like me wouldn't even notice that an editor was saying or that the process is lacking?
I don't know. I mean, you're asking me what I think you, I mean, you, I think you've personally started very successful companies, and you have a very successful flaw. I mean, I don't know what you describe, how you describe Mixergy right now, but you do know all this stuff. Like, you're doing it all
I feel that when I watch certain interviewers who are not in the tech space do interviews with tech entrepreneurs, I watch them glorifying people who had graceful exits that were really not exits.
Right.
And the reason is they're not in this space. They don't know it. They don't know these problems. There's a reason why I knew early on about Eric Ries before he was the guy who wrote the Lean Startup. It's because I was in a parking lot with the founder of Lookout, who today people might know as software, but back then he was just a guy. And he told me about Eric Ries, and then he told me what questions he wanted to know from Eric Ries because he was a nobody. He wanted some access to this guy's information. The reason I knew to ask those questions, the reason I know who to have on is because I'm in it. I'm living and breathing. And I'm wondering for you, did you experience anything like that?
Well, I was sending out work. I use our software as a writer. I send out work to publishers. So I experience it every single day. And then, you know, we later launched an HR version of our software and we use it. And every day I'm like, well, I wish I could do this. So, you know, I think that's incredibly valuable. But I think most people know that. Like, you should eat your own dog food and all that. But I mean, it just had to work, right? You know, I don't know if it was anything, like, there was just no choice but to make this work.
You know, from anyone else, Michael, if you said it just had to work, I would have to dig in further or just say, oh, I've heard it before. But the reason that I think it's especially important for you to say it, even though you've repeated it several times, is because I do look at the comments of past interviews, and I do see that there are people who say, I don't relate to this guy because I'm not in so many words, but I don't relate to this guy because I've got a mortgage, I've got a family. For me, it's not possible. And when you say, okay, for me, it is possible because of that, it had to happen because of that, it's very powerful.
Yeah, I think so. So the 40-year-old thing, mortgage, kids, like, you just have to do just every single day, do some little thing, and it all adds up. I mean, yeah, I run into people like, oh, well, actually, I just talked to two friends who are thinking about starting a company. And I told them sort of how hard it was going to be. And I validated their idea and told them, like, great idea and everything. And told them just sort of like how to get going. And they immediately start talking like, okay, we can start this in March, because then we'll be freed up by then. And the obvious thing was, no, you have to start this right now. You got to go home and, like, go get the website. And, like, you got to do something every single day. At YC, it was even more like, you know, one of the first things we learned at YC, like, some of the YC partners are younger than us, but we would sit down and they would ask what our problems were. And, we would say something and they would get up and say, okay, let's fix it. You know, like, immediately, like, you know, Gary Tan, I was like, I hate my front page. Okay, let's make another, like, it pulls out his computer and just starts making another one. And I think that urge to just not, like, wonder whether it's going to be hard. You know, I mean, I'm friends with very, very smart people. Like, I've been a professor, and there is just this, like, it's night and day when you describe a problem or you describe, like, a goal, and people immediately start listing, like, how hard it's going to be or problems, versus someone's like, okay, well, we can do this today. Like, you know, before we finish this cup of coffee, we can, like, write the whatever. Like, they can't even help themselves. They have to do it. They have to, like, just move and get it done. And it feels haphazard. And especially if you're an accomplished person, like, it doesn't look 100%. It's kind of ugly and weird, but whatever the thing you're doing, you're, like, jumping forward in some way. And I think if I was, you know, what I would recommend to anybody who's 40 and has kids and has a day job and they don't ever see themselves getting out from under it, it's just to do something every single day and not even worry about whether it's going to be huge. But, like, this stuff just builds. Like, there's no, like, you can't, I will not compete against somebody who I know is going to just show up every single day. I'll compete against somebody who has 190 IQ. I'm not worried about smart or clever people. I'm worried about sickos who will never give up. I mean, right?
You ran out of money a couple of times.
Yeah.
Why? What happened?
You know, it's just very hard. There's not a quote-unquote market for early-stage companies in Missoula, Montana. and, you know, it always takes three times longer than you think. I was selling to people like Adam Robinson, a poet, and, you know, like, my clients were didn't have money. So it's, you know, it's just hard. But I never ran out of money and said, let's give up. I ran out of money and said, I'm a partner with, I have three partners, but I feel like I'm the one responsible for the money. And we just made it happen. I mean, there was two times in particular. So we've been around for almost 2.5 years, 3 years. And there were two times in particular where we're out of money, just zero. And we didn't raise a lot of money in the beginning. You know, we bootstrapped for most of it. And we consulted and stuff in the beginning as well. But when we talked John into quitting his job, so one of us was not working full time. and that was on us, you know, like... but I look both those times, something sort of magical happened and I can't explain it, but you just do the thing that makes it possible. And it, you know, we got very lucky.
And you're sickos who show up every day.
And we're sickos. one of our first investors outside of Montana's, New York, awesome person. And he has a small angel company called 77 Ventures. And I moved to New York for 3 months and, you know, I was used to being broke and my family was still here. And I moved there to talk to customers and I couldn't afford an apartment. So I just said, well, I'll come to New York. He wanted me to come to New York to talk to big publishers. And so I said, I can't afford an apartment. And he jokingly said, well, you can sleep on our couch in his office. And I thought he was serious. I was like, okay, great. and then he realized I was serious and I slept on my investor's couch for about a month. And he probably doesn't want me telling this, but at some point, another people would come in and be like, who's the dude on your couch? And one of our later investors came in and said, who's the guy on your couch? And Corbin said, it's this crazy entrepreneur from Montana. He's got this company, they actually have customers. And, you know, he had me come out and talk about the product. And this investor later came in and we 5X'd his money, by the way. But he basically just said, I don't really understand this and I can't imagine making money in the literature market. But if you're crazy enough to sleep on the couch, I'm in, right?
Unreal. And when you say you 5X his money, he's still an investor. You're just saying the valuation is increased.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's still even more to come.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't even get into what your predictions were for 2013 for revenue, because who could tell with predictions? But
yeah, I think we're growing it. I imagine we will hit $500,000 a month in transactions. Probably by June, but again, right.
And right now you have 4,000 clients, 500,000 users who are submitting to those 4,000 clients. So there's a lot of activity going on there.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's impressive.
Yeah.
All right.
4 million documents total. We did a count a couple of weeks ago. But right, you know, like 4,000 or 5,000 a day documents, and they can have, I mean, submissions, and a submission can be up to 25 documents.
Here's something that I wanted to follow up with you on. Before we started, you said, I talked about how I can make this a useful interview for you because, excuse me, it's going to be so useful to the audience. And you said, I'm not really looking for customers here because we have a direct sales model. And I thought, so confident that he doesn't need more customers at this process. And he's got this machine, this direct sales model. What is that direct sales model?
So it changes all the time. But in the very beginning, I cold called people. And I'd email them and I would cold call them and I wasn't really selling anything. I was sort of talking about them. And actually you guys had a great, I can't remember. I think he's Irish.
Yes.
What was his name?
Kennedy. Why can't I think of his name? James Kennedy.
Yeah. So he was awesome. Like everything he said.
The course that he did on how to do cold calling.
Yes.
And he's awesome. Like us. He's not the guy who feels comfortable getting on the phone and chatting people up.
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah. As soon as I saw, I was just, I mean, I watched that a couple of times. But I didn't realize what I was doing. We had two very early investors in Missoula, Montana. These guys, Steve Zaroff and Glenn Kreisel started the company called Remote Scan. Two They are not, they're just guys. And they sold it to Quest, which got bought by Dell 2 years ago. They're multimillionaires, no investors. And they were very early on, they gave me a little bit of money, enough to hang myself. But they also, part of, they gave us a little bit of money and they said, let's talk in 4 months. If you, they sort of wanted to see if we would grow. But they also met with me every single week. Steve said, just come over every Tuesday and we'll just talk. And we talked about all kinds of stuff. And I was stressed out and freaked out. But he would also do things like he would say, okay, let's write a cold call script to the CEO of Southwest Airlines magazine. Like, that magazine, And
Freebie.
he, I thought this was a waste of time because I didn't, that market, I didn't understand. I understood literature and stuff. But we would just sit there and write it. And it was very different than what a writer would write. Like it was very direct, and it was you're talking to a CEO, so you got to be. There's only so much time in the day. It's got to be about revenue. Are you solving a problem? Like all these things that you don't think about when you're writing literature, you're trying to sort of be entertaining. And so we'd write it, and he'd be like, "Okay, great, great, go home, and or polish it. Come back next week." So the next Tuesday, I'd go over to his house, middle of the day. And I'd had the script, and he'd be like, "Okay, here's his phone number. Do it." And that kind of stuff. We just got incredibly lucky to meet those kinds of people early on, and later YC and stuff like that. But those, that I don't know how you replicate that. Getting lucky to meet those kinds of people very early on,
I think
especially in a
there's
liberal.
something about you that draws them in, and the audience can see that. And I'm not saying it as flattery. I'm saying it because I've got to be thorough here, and I can't dismiss things as luck when I could see in front of my eyes that it's more than luck. You, of course, can be humble, and you can say that. But
Well, anyway,
let me say this. Well, first of all, I'm so glad that I asked about that. I've got just a couple more minutes here, and I know that we started a little bit late because we had some tech issues getting started. Do you have about 5 more minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, great. Okay. So first, I always want to do a plug at this point in the interview. And at this point, I'm going to keep it short because we kind of got to the plug within the interview. Michael talked about the one course that we have with an entrepreneur who decided, hey, I can't wait for people to come to my site and buy from me. I'm a little too desperate. And so he got over his lack of passion, let's say, for making cold calls, and he started making cold calls, and he had this process that he went through. His name is James Kennedy. If you're a premium member, it's at mixergypremium.com, and you'll see it right there for you to watch. And if you're not, please join. In addition to getting all this value for yourself, you're also supporting this site here and helping us grow, bring in more pre-interviewers, researchers, and making this more useful for entrepreneurs everywhere. So mixergypremium.com. Oh, here's what I wanted it to close with. People have been asking me for tools and books that entrepreneurs who I interview use and read, and I thought we can go through some that you recommend, some that you use, and maybe some people in the audience can use. So why don't we
Sure.
start with tools?
Okay, so I think I mentioned OLARC, which so OLARC sort of that little contact us pop-up at the bottom of your screen,
Yep.
and it's great for sales for people on your site and they have questions. But what we found was really wildly useful was we plugged it into our application. So when you're in our application and there's 30,000 editors a day in our application, we have that in there, and you should make it a configurable that they can turn it off if they want because it can get annoying. But we also, it's just a great way to communicate. So if your application's complex, or if it's close to enterprise software, it's really like the hardest thing once you sell them is actually getting them to use it a lot. And so this just puts us right in their face. They can ask us questions, and that gets used so much. And
Wow, so
it's
not just to get people to sign up, you're saying OLARC can also help you get people to use your product more often. And so you pop it up or you make it available to them so that if they have any issues or questions or about to drop off, you can come in and help them out.
Yeah, so it's incredibly useful help tool, sort of
Okay.
like your we use user voice for our help forum, and that
Why
has
do you like
great
user
API.
voice out of all the different tools that are out there?
What's that?
Why user voice out of all the different options?
I don't want to talk about the ones we tried two or three others, but we found that user voice is an API, so we can our users don't have to log in to another system. They've got it's just a very, very well thought out tool. Like all of them, you know, everybody's changing, everyone's working on it, so it's getting better and better. But the API sort of put it over the edge. We use Mailgun for transaction mails.
Mailgun.
Yeah, Mailgun. I think so that's emails within the system for the non-developers. It's basically how emails can be sent to and from users within your application. SendGrid is great too. We just, for whatever reason, we use Mailgun.
And the reason you need Mailgun is because you want to ensure delivery. You don't want to have to figure it out yourself. Mailgun takes care of the delivery issues.
The big one they do is they help you, they keep you off spam list.
Keep you off spam list.
But they also help with tracking. You know, we can help, it's perfect for debugging. We can see to make sure that emails, if it didn't get there, why didn't it get there? And I use Mad Mimi for my newsletters. There's Constant Contact and MailChimp. But what I love about Mad Mimi is the user interface. They recently upgraded their UI, and they have these buttons that I can only describe as juicy.
Juicy.
They have juicy software.
The thing is their design. It's always beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Just sort of blown away by that. What else? FreshBooks, which I used. I don't use so much for our company, but I used it as a freelance writer a lot. And that's going back 2 or 3 years from when they first got started. But I was always really impressed with their attention to detail and their design. What else?
For tracking links, you told me about a program that you use.
Oh, Kit is a great, and that's a fellow YC company, but it's a great link. I centralize all my links there, and you can share them. So there's sort of social tools around that.
KIPPT, tracking links that you share with other people in the company and outside.
That's right, yeah.
And then there's one other one for voicemail that I never heard of before you.
For voicemail.
VoiceGem. What's VoiceGem?
Oh, VoiceGem. Yeah. So VoiceGem is a dead simple way of sending voicemails. So it gives you an interface, lets you talk directly into your computer. And I used it when I was at YC for sending my kids messages. So I would send them an email at night, and I would just, or over the course of the day, something occurred to me, and I would tell them a joke or do whatever. And you just put it in their email address. So it would go to my wife, and my wife could hit play, and my kids could hear me telling them a joke or reading a book to them. And what's nice compared to, say, Skype, because we would Skype as well. But what I liked about it was, you know, you're not forced into this time frame. You can do it as it occurs to you. And it's just a really fun, simple application. And I think they just launched an iPhone app, which I haven't used it, but I imagine it's going to be great.
All right. How about a couple of books?
So I think we talked about how I sort of came to entrepreneur, or the first thing that opened my eyes to it was the Founders at Work by
Jessica Livingston, Y Combinator co-founder. And I should also say for the transcribers, when he said YC, let's get those letters right, because there are new entrepreneurs out there who need to know about Y Combinator, YC.
Yeah.
So what is it about Founders at Work?
So how I came to it was I read this book called Please Kill Me, which is an oral history of punk rock, which is also a great book. But as a writer, I was at the time really interested in how to make language utterly natural. And I loved, I was just sort of studying the sentences of Please Kill Me. And so then I started looking for other, not oral histories, but either interviews or things where people would be transcribed from how they spoke. And I don't know what the actual road was to Founders at Work, but I came up, I somehow found that. And this was in 2008, so it must have just come out. And I bought it. And what was amazing, I mean, the thing that was, I liked it on a language level. It wasn't quite as unique as, say, Iggy Pop describing his first concerts in frat houses at, I think it was the University of Michigan. But But what it was that these people seemed, they seemed like freaks. They seemed like people that I would hang out with. Like I had always thought of entrepreneurs or as business as this sort of wonky MBA, Excel sheets. But these just seemed like friends of mine. And their struggles were basically, I have no idea what I'm doing. How do I keep going? I related to that from the writing, from my writing life. And so it just made it all seem very possible. Jessica's an awesome interviewer. So that was one of my favorite books. For actual business books, I like Crossing the Chasm, which is how do you get something from a niche into a mass market. It's a little bit wonkier. I like the Christensen's books, the Innovator's Dilemma. What's the last? That Mark Benioff book, Behind the Cloud, is pretty great. Yeah, I mean it's a little salesy, but I like what he was trying to do in the beginning, which is create conversation around your software. As I'm trying to use Salesforce right now, it's kind of a nightmare. I just signed up, but it's just a beast. But I like what he's talking about in the beginning, and he's not. I think he'd be an exception from where most of us are coming from. But I do think what's really valuable is how you get people talking and creating community around your software, and how you get your early customers to help you, and they essentially take ownership of your company and of your software. And it's uncomfortable giving them ownership, but that's how they make it awesome, you know.
Yeah, well, so, you have to do it at your business. And thanks for help for coming here and getting the conversation going about what's happening behind the business.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. I always say this over and over, that if you get any value out of this interview or even anything else online, that you should find a way to thank the person who you're listening to. And I had the founder of Greatest here in my office. We just had a drink because he happened to be in town. And he said, Andrew, the people who are in the audience are amazing. They started calling him and emailing him. And he was telling me that he spent, I think it was hours, just on the phone with people helping them out. Not because they asked for it. And I'm not saying that people need to do this. All my interviewees should not do this. But because it just was a natural extension of the relationship that starts when you say, thank you. And so I'm going to say thank you, right?
Uh-huh. Can I add one quick piece to that? Like anything. One of the most illuminating things I found growing up as I became an adult, is that people love helping you. And if you give them an easy way to do that, like if someone sends me an email and they ask a specific question, or if they ask to meet me and they give me a time, like I get these emails like, can we have coffee sometime? And that's like a nightmare. But if someone's like, can we meet at 1 o'clock on Thursday and I buy you lunch or something? And then you just have to yes, no it. Like that's so much more valuable. But the other thing that I think people just often forget is that people love helping other people. And even in the business world, you know, like if somebody knows how to cold call, or you know that they've sold cars or whatever, like, you know, they will absolutely give you lunch or whatever it is. I think it's the people think you're bothering them, and sometimes you are, but yeah.
But that's good advice, to be specific about when you want to meet, and also what you're looking to talk about. If it's just, hey, let's mindlessly have a pick your brain session, then I don't know where we're going.
That's right. Right.
Okay. Well, I'm honored to have had you on here. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I really love your show. Cheers.
Thank you. I shouldn't have cut you off as you were saying you love my show.
I do want to say one thing. You know, you were sort of doubting your abilities or talking about, like, I think the secret sauce that you have is this sort of sincerity and the background of knowing exactly where most of your interviewees are in the process. But I don't think that's something you can learn. You know, like it's incredibly valuable. And that's why I enjoy your show so much.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Right. Cheers.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.